Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday over there.
I was biting a cough drop, and I didn't want to go crunch, crunch, crunch into the microphone, so I apologize.
Which you just did.
Gosh, crunch, darn it. Crunch.
Chris Gasso.
Hello.
And Nicole Lane.
Hello.
How's everybody this evening?
Crunch, crunch, crunch.
We're crunchy. All right. So, hey, let's get right into it.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, we were talking about city-specific comics, and we brought up the Green River Killer, who, when I was growing up here in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, was the local boogeyman. Mm-hmm. And so that brought up the topic of true crime comics. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what other true crime comics are out there. Now, there's plenty of crime comics,
yes,
from what I hear. There's a whole section over there, apparently,
yeah,
of crime comics. But what are the true crime comics that are available?
Do you want to start?
Sure. I am not a big fan of true crime. And much to my dear friend Chris Casso's chagrin, I like Brian Michael Bendis. And when Brian Michael Bendis first appeared on the scene, his thing was crime fiction. Goldfish and Jinx, mm-hmm, was his book. But he did this really cool book. I thought it was a very, very cool series. It was a six-part series back in 1998 called Torso. And it was originally published out of Caliber, I think.
I believe so.
But it's never been out of print, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, Marvel's got it now. Yeah.
But what it is a story of the serial murder case in Cleveland, Ohio.
I think so.
It's basically the story of what killed Elliot Ness's career. Because when he was heading the Untouchables during Prohibition and brought down Al Capone, he transferred to chief of police at the Cleveland police department, and they were dealing with, this is 1935, and they were dealing with a serial killer, a torso killer.
Well, so if I remember correctly, too, was that the first categorized as such serial killer?
Yeah, that's the way they marketed the book, and I think that's kind of the way they market the story. It's a fascinating read. It's dense, six issues. It's drawn by Mark Andreyko, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would like to go back and reread it. But the truth of the matter is that in reality, they never solved the crime.
Yeah.
And it did kill Elliot Ness's career because, well, he was a hammer. He was never a detective, but he was also a rock star in the public's eye and a bit of a superhero. So, after he, knocked down one of the biggest crime bosses in Chicago, surely he should be able to figure out how to catch this serial killer. But that's really kind of what began that, cultural fascination with the pathological killers and that sort of thing. I think in the comic book, do you remember, Chris, not to do any spoilers, but do they have some kind of resolution in the comic book?
They make up a fictitious sort of ending.
He kind of does his own thing.
Yeah.
I think that it also ruined Ness's marriage as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of just messed him up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being able to solve that one.
And Brian Michael and Mark, from what I understand, scoured over like microfiche and like all kinds of things to try to get as much information to pump into the book.
It's not footnoted as heavily as, say, From Hell, but it's still.
No, but I think that they
really
put their work
read.
In yeah. to doing that book. Yeah.
And From Hell is another true crime comic.
From Hell was one to mention. Also worth mentioning, My Friend Dahmer by Durf Backderf.
Durf Backderf, yep.
And
Durf is the guy that went to high school with Dahmer.
Yeah. So it's Jeff in high school before all of the killing. He did some stuff, I think, when he was younger, but I think it was with animals, not human animals.
Kind of how it starts, from what I understand.
Yeah, usually, yeah.
Yeah, if you torture animals. Jeffrey Dahmer, of course, the famous serial killer who, I think, lured people into a van, did that stereotypical thing. There was there was a story that came out about him, an interesting story. I don't know if this is in the comic, but the police on a corner, they saw this kid running towards him in like his underwear,
mm-hmm,
and said, "Help me, help me." And Dahmer came out and said, "Oh, this is just like my nephew. Sorry, he's gonna weird in the head." And the cops were like, "All right, well, they sent it back."
And
with
sent back, and then
kid ended up getting killed
and
eaten.
Yeah.
So on that level,
he was a necrophile and a bit of a cannibal. Yeah. And he was homosexual.
Right. Because he picked up all of his victims at gay bars, correct? In Milwaukee.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. But the whole thing on my friend Dahmer is that it's just like day-to-day sort of like him in high school.
Was he just a standard average kid?
I never read the book.
Yeah. Has any of us? I never read it. Did you read it?
No, and right now the printing is tricky to get back in stock. We haven't had it for a little while.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, but between that and Green River Killer, we've sold a lot of those.
I think Dahmer was also spent some time here in Seattle or Tacoma. I may be completely wrong about that, and it's possible that I am. What else we got?
Rick Geary's Treasury of Victorian Murders.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a bunch of those, and they all focus like one's on the Borden tragedy, one's Black Dahlia, one's Mary Rogers, The Beast of Chicago.
He did Jack the Ripper as well.
Yeah.
It's all the stuff from the 20th century. And Richard Geary, or Rick Geary, is how he goes by. He always did these sort of gothic line, really pretty black and white line work.
Very curvy, curvilinear cartoons. He contributed a lot to those factoid books I talked about a couple episodes back.
And there is one of those that's the Big Book of Criminals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think there's some true crime story in one of those.
Exactly.
And he would do like A is for Amy, who whatever, like, and it was always morbid things and going through the alphabet. I don't know. I was really into that because being a morbid child. But then he does these ones.
Sweetie, you're still a morbid child.
Well, I'm still a child. I'm an adult. I'm a kid adult. So,
kid adult.
To be clear.
That's nice. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the Beast of Chicago? Do we know what that is?
I don't really, actually. I was just going through the names tonight. Like, there's a couple that I want to learn
not
about
the,
now.
The World's Fair Killer, is it?
I don't know.
Devil in the White City. Eric Larson, not Eric Larson, the comic book writer, there's a really interesting book called Devil in the White City about the World's Fair murderer.
But that whole like, A is for Arthur, runs through like some sort of Edward Gorey.
Exactly.
Kind of,
What do you call it?
Oh, is that not? Oh, maybe I'm thinking of him then, because his work is almost exactly the same as Rick. Edward Gorey. That's
and
what I was thinking.
Rick Geary?
Yeah.
Maybe it's the. No. Have we ever seen them in the same room?
My
have we seen
just
them in the same room as the Beast of Chicago?
Because I was like, clearly somebody who wants to make creepy kid stories also wants to talk about murders from the 20th century, right?
I think we just dropped a bombshell here on the podcast.
See.
Anyway, so Nicole, do you have any other true crime comics?
Well, there's also one that he has right there, The Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
Which is an adaptation of a novel, a critically acclaimed novel by James Ellroy, and it goes through the Black Dahlia. So,
see, I've actually read the Ellroy novel because I went through this period where I was very intrigued by the Black Dahlia murder case, and still kind of am. But I got bored and frustrated because I got into some real quagmire kind of stories. This is a terrific story because
the art is really pretty inside too.
I have not read this graphic novel, but the Ellroy book was really fascinating. But there are tons of speculative fiction stories based on this murder case that was unsolved.
At the prompting of a friend of mine, I bought and read a book by Steve Hodel called The Black Dahlia Avenger, and he was the son of the lead detective on that case. And he claims to have solved it. And you'll never guess who he fingers to be the murderer.
Is that the one where it's his dad?
It's his dad.
Yeah. I remember reading about that. And I was like, oh, please.
Now, the book is completely fascinating and utterly dry.
Oh.
It
is
boring,
how can it be both?
Procedural. But like, and it's like 300 pages long, and it's really, he goes in depth. And I read the entire thing. And afterwards, I'm like, well, that didn't really. Wasn't a very exciting read, but it's certainly fascinating.
Were you convinced that his dad was the killer?
By the end of it, yeah.
Really?
I mean, I had no other suspects.
God, he must have really hated his dad, man.
All right, what do you got there, Chris?
I've got Jack Kirby's In the Days of the Mob. And these were some magazines he did that most people have forgotten about. And earlier I wasn't quite sure if they could be counted as true crime, but there is a note in the foreword by John Morrow, who publishes the Jack Kirby Collector magazine, mm-hmm. so he did his research, where everything that he can find is that these stories are factually accurate accounts of real-life criminals. And it's focusing on the rise of organized crime in the days of Prohibition via Jack Kirby. So there's going to be a lot of action lines and a lot of very square jaws. But it's kind of a weird mix, because if you've read plenty of Jack Kirby, you wouldn't necessarily think crime would be the thing to focus on, but it's very dynamic.
God, you know, it just boggles my brain sometimes how prolific that man was. It just really amazes
me. He never stopped working.
So, no, he never did.
And this is, it's a couple years old now, but DC got their hands on doing a bunch of nice archival versions of all of their Jack Kirby archive. So they were like, oh, we got this too. And then they shoved that out. Mm-hmm. So that is a pretty cool one to check out.
Awesome. Cool. Any others we want to mention before we move on?
I think that covered what that's we it. All had we're compiled. We all compiled about the same amount of information. Yeah. So,
alrighty, cool. So that's your true crime novel. If you want to follow up on any of those, I will put links to them in the show notes. But let's move on and go from true crime to cryptozoological comics.
Very different world.
Cryptozoology. So, now, who wants to take the definition of what cryptozoology is?
Well,
because obviously I know what it means. I just want to see if you know what it means.
I really... I have to thank Nicole for this one, because...
this is Nicole's idea.
It was Nicole's idea, but I've been a freak for cryptozoology going back to graduate school. Just a little sidebar, personal side note. I one of the few plays I ever actually wrote and produced was about a fella, a little metaphorical trip through the Congo about this man looking for the last dinosaur, the Mekele Mbembe. And it was kind of an extrapolated metaphor for AIDS. And if a dinosaur could survive whatever catastrophe that happened to them, then we could survive that. What was looking to be the plague that, as far as I was concerned, would destroy us all. So, but I got really into cryptozoology. Back in the day, there was actually a scientific journal from the International Society of Cryptozoology. But let's define it.
Yes, let's define it first. Before this train
cryptozoology
leaves.
It's the study of, and this is the most very particular and dry version definition, the study of evidence tending to substantiate the existence of or the search for creatures whose reported existence is unproved, as in the Yeti or the Loch Ness Monster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or Sasquatch for us here in the Pacific Northwest.
Or mermaids or...
Or Bigfoots. So there's the one side that... There was the one aspect of cryptozoology where they're actually dealing with just undiscovered fauna. Undiscovered animals, and there are discussions of, like, say, the pygmy hippo, but then side by side with examination of Bigfoot print casts. So there's always been really fascinating stuff, and from time to time, the subject matter shows up in comics.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And with that, let's move on to what comics these show up in.
In doing the research, and you guys can back me up on this, one thing I realized is that. Aside from, say, supporting characters in the big two, like, say, Sasquatch and Alpha Flight, there are seldom mainstream comics that relate to or delve into cryptozoology. It's really been the domain, from my experience, of the independent publisher and the short-term independent publishers. But I could be wrong on that.
I mean, you have creatures show up, maybe... Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, there was
werewolves, fish people, whatever,
There's an issue of Garth Ennis's Punisher where there was a mobster who was really, 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 really interested in finding a giant squid. Mm-hmm. And like, it was like this weird subplot to a Punisher story. And then finally a giant squid came and killed him.
Well, speaking of the Punisher, one of my favorite Punisher stories was it was a two-parter in Punisher War Journal back in, I'm looking at my notes here.
I don't know how you read your own handwriting.
Oh no, well, you know what? That makes two of us right now.
Do you need some stall time?
Yeah, okay. Please help me stall.
So one of the best cryptozoological books is Proof, and that's by Alexander Grecian and Riley Rossmo, who I'm a big fan of and found his art through Greenwake. But it's like government officials who deal with these cryptozoological creatures like fairies and things like that. But one of the guys is Sasquatch.
Okay.
And his name is, I forget his name. What's his name? It's like Proofian something, and they call him Proof for short.
All right.
You know, something like that. Yeah.
So Sasquatch is a character?
Sasquatch is one of the main characters.
Okay.
And he's part of this this team of people in hopes of maybe being able to find his own family.
Okay.
And, you know, in the meantime, they're coming across, like, you know, other violent Sasquatches or, you know, troublesome fairies and, like, you know, just different creatures.
Hmm. Sounds kind of Hellboyish.
I guess it has a little elements to that. But this was a series that came out many years ago.
Yeah.
It's had multitude of volumes and stuff. But it will tell you different things, like definitions, like a cryptoid. Most cryptoids originate in one location and move outward. And, you know, it'll just give you,
so
like,
facts. It's a bit of a primer.
So I thought that one would really encapsulate, you know,
you know, I remember seeing that comic on the stands, but I never took a look at it, so now I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
The Punisher book that I wanted to talk about was, there was a two-parter in Punisher War Journal back in 1992 that was dear to my heart because it's Wolverine and Punisher in the Congo, and they're actually looking for the dinosaur I mentioned earlier that I wrote the play about, Mikelly and Bembe. And it was reprinted a couple of times in, they call it the African Saga. But actually, it was originally a two-parter in 1988. It was drawn by Jim Lee and written by Carl Potts. I don't think I have it anymore, but I have fond memories of that story. Do you remember that at all?
Mm-hmm. Was it any good?
I don't think I really cared because it, you know, at that time I thought Jim Lee was kind of a cool illustrator, and it had the Mikelly and Bembe in it, and Potts actually credited Roy Mackle, I believe he was the secretariat of the International Society of Cryptozoology. I was corresponding with him at that time when I was writing the play because he lived in Chicago, and I can burn up all kinds of air in this room telling stories about this very eccentric gentleman calling me at 5 a.m. to answer all of my questions that I had written him. This is in the days before everybody emailed, and he would call me at like 5 a.m. and just start babbling at me. Mm-hmm. But he'd gone to the Congo. I know this because I saw him in documentaries on the Discovery Channel. Hmm. He was for reals. He just was wackadoody. I don't know if he's still around. I have autographed copies of his book. One book is called A Living Dinosaur, A Living Dinosaur, The Search for the Mikelly and Bembe in the Congo. And then he spent like 10 years on Loch Ness. And I have a copy of his Loch Ness book as
What's his name again?
Professor Roy Mackle.
Well, Professor Roy Mackle, if you are listening to this, email Cole at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com.
You know,
he'd love to get 5 a.m. phone calls from you again.
I don't think he liked my play. I sent him a copy.
Is it the last time you heard from him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Geez.
Other books.
Yeah.
There was Mojo Press did this kind of cool book called The Bigfoot Book, which I have published in 1996. It was an anthology of all these different artists from the time. That one's really kind of fun. There's a book called Perhaponauts, which has had sporadic limited series. You know, the protagonists of that are like a Sasquatch, a Chupacabra, and somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Perhaponauts and Proof came out at almost the exact same time,
right.
Which is why I ignored both of them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I picked up a copy of Perhaponauts, and it just wasn't happening for me, so I didn't pursue it any further. There's another book called Department of Monsterology that looked like more of the same kind of stuff. The one that caused me great consternation was the Steve Niles, Richard Corbin Bigfoot book. And I hesitate to say that it was actually offensive because it depicts Bigfoot as this giant, hairy, voracious psychopath where, you know, it's violent in the strain of Richard Corbin violence, and everybody looks like, everybody's bodies looks like they're made out of putty. Yeah.
Globular.
Yeah, and the blood sprays. And I was like, oh, that's, I don't, and Niles, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with Steve Niles. He created 30 Days of Night, mm-hmm. and he's been the one that's been writing the Frankenstein Alive Alive. That's the sequel
which
to Mary's.
We may never see the ending of,
but I think it's fascinating. I did an interview with him years and years ago when 30 Days of Night came out. But I really didn't care for that Bigfoot book. I just thought it was really over the top. And
it was offensive to Bigfoots?
It was offensive to Bigfoots and the people who love them.
12-year-old boys?
That live inside of this 50-year-old man.
Hey, see, I didn't mention how old you were. You did that on your own.
Yeah, I did do that on mine. Okay, last little tidbit I want to share was there was a cartoon that I was actually quite fond of called The Secret Saturdays. Did anybody remember this on Cartoon Network?
Mm-mm.
Nope.
Oh, man. It ran for 2 seasons in 2010, and it was a family of cryptozoological specialists, and they would go around the world saving their team. It's mom, dad, and son, Zach, I think Zach, because Zach was a real hip name back then, and their job was they were cryptozoological investigators, but their whole job was to preserve them, to keep them secret from this bad guy named Vivi Argost, because he had this reality TV show where he'd capture these critters, and that was their job to protect them from the world.
Oh, that's nice.
You guys never saw Secret Saturdays? Oh. Mm-hmm. All right.
I stopped watching cartoons, but
you know, and that's where you've gone wrong, Ben. That's where you've gone wrong.
I watch adult cartoons these days. Yeah. Like Archer,
Bojack Horseman.
Yeah. Love me some Bojack Horseman. All right, do either of you have any other cryptozoological? All right, Nicole, what is
Manifest
that?
Manifest Destiny has a whole bunch of them in there.
Really?
Yeah. They have, I guess it depends on what you consider to be cryptozoological, because there's minotaurs in there, but I don't know that people believe that necessarily.
Those are mythical. Those aren't cryptozoological.
Yeah,
there's no real proof. Okay,
it merges.
There's no footprints.
It's a fusion.
It's a fusion because they're buffalo minotaurs, and then there's Cyclops Sasquatch.
I've never read this book, but I keep reading good things about it. Have you guys read
this?
It's
great. We all like this book a lot.
How many volumes are there now?
There's 3 right now.
Huh. Okay. Missed the boat on that one.
Yeah.
All right.
Is it about like Lewis and Clark going across the
and fighting monsters?
They got secret orders from the president.
Yeah,
nice.
Kill
monsters. Mm-hmm. And there's giant like artifacts and things that they come across that are like beginning to add up, and they're like something's really wrong. The more we go west, and it's a lot of fun. Hmm. Another one cool. I was going to mention is Fantagraphics published 2 hardcovers called Beasts, just Beast 1, Beast 2. And what they just did was they were like an alphabet of cryptozoological creatures, and some they went to mythology as well. And they just got different artists, a lot of them underground or independent, to illustrate each one of the creatures. They might be out of print now, but they're really nice art books, and it's just kind of an unusual melding of styles and content.
Cool.
Awesome. Do we look at cryptozoological characters in a different light than we do, say, mythical characters or like superheroes? Because cryptozoological might actually exist, or you know, they're rooted in reality more so than, say, mythology or superheroes.
It's a fuzzy zone, and I think that's why stuff like this. I know there's a new society for cryptozoology, but I don't think they publish. An academic journal, because you guys, this is hardcore academic stuff here. But you know, it walks that fine line, and really struggled to treat some of these sea serpent stories and whatnot as though they were credible research.
You say sea serpents. I would have to also include lumberjanes into this conversation.
Okay, because there's sea serpents
and lumberjanes. Because there are some interesting creatures like that
show up.
But
going back to Ben's question about...
just why do we find it, like, why is it in a different, like, fascination plane?
I mean, there's more conspiracy around that than with mythology. Like, we can have a little bit more fantasy with our mythos than we can with thinking that some huge primate is existing in our forests right now. And it's just like with UFOs and, things like that.
With UFOs, with
UFO comics.
UFO comics.
there are a bunch of those.
With comics, what we need to acknowledge and need to recognize on a regular basis, because I think it's good for us all, is is to realize that we as human beings are symbol-making creatures. We make mythology. We just have, we create different words for those mythologies. When I got done writing the Dinosaur in the Congo play, the next one I wanted to write about was the whole alien abduction mythology, because that fascinated me. But I looked upon it as a contemporary mythology. But why? There were so many people so convinced that this was a thing, and it was a way of life for people, and it was a belief system, and there was a certain amount of religiosity about it. Why? Why? Why does that happen? Why do we make those realities for ourselves? And I started digging into the research on that, and
did you ever come up with a conclusion?
No, that's why I didn't write the play.
All right, well, let's move on.
No, seriously, that's why. I was like, there's no definitive answer on this one. I got to walk away.
Cool.
But well, I still got all the books.
That's great. Thanks, friends. I'm sure we'll come back to this topic in a future date. But let's move on to Book Report, and Cole Hornaday, let's start with you.
Well, speaking of mythological creatures...
There we go.
As promised a couple episodes back, I claimed I was going to read Simon Spurrier and Ryan Kelly's Cry Havoc, Volume 1.
Are there dogs of war in there?
Precisely.
All right.
Yeah, for those who are not unaware, Cry Havoc is a snippet of a quote from William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Cry Havoc and let slip the dogs of war. And I actually looked up that little sidebar. I looked up the definition because it is actually permutated over time.
I didn't want to say the whole thing because I don't actually know what it is.
Yeah. It's permutated over time because dogs of war now has come to mean mercenaries.
Yeah.
In our contemporary context, but a dog of war is, you know, in the time period of Shakespeare was actually a soldier, and actually that's what the story is about. It's about mythological beings who get conscripted to be sort of black ops. Soldiers, and our protagonist, I can't think of remember her name just this, at the moment. She's not actually a werewolf. She is a black shuck or a black dog, a mythical black dog. So none of these characters are really cryptozoological. They are all drawn from different, they're all lycanthropes, they're all shapeshifters. They all get conscripted into this secret govern ops to go bust this community in the Middle East. I really wanted to like everything about this book. Aww. I did not, because Mr. Spurrier is, and I will go into greater detail of why I feel this way. He is an incredibly pedantic writer, and probably is a tremendous journalist. But this book reminded me so much of other stories like this that still did not deliver on their promise. It feels like it's like Grimm. It's like it smacks of Grimm. It smacks of Clive Barker's Nightbreed, where you get introduced to this underworld of creatures, but there's no real follow through. There's no real development. You're still kind of left going, okay, why? where are we going with this? Now, that's not to say I didn't dislike the book, because I actually enjoyed the book, but one of the reasons I enjoyed the book is this man has about 12 pages of endnotes. And this
Ben's a lot of words.
Yeah, he's got annotations in it where he tells you all about the research he did and who these characters and who the mythological point of origin for all these characters are, where they come from. And I gotta tell you, that was far more fascinating to me than the actual comic book. And in our TL:DR reality. I don't know if a lot of people are going to be able to appreciate this, but I sure did.
For those out there who don't know the internet, TLDR is too long, didn't read.
Right.
Let me ask you a question about process,
sir,
for that movie.
Yeah.
You said it's annotated in the back. Are there little asterisks on each page that tell you?
Okay. No, he's noted the page numbers.
Okay.
So it goes that way.
So you can't, as you're going along, you can't like go back and see.
No, you were not distracted by that, which is kind of a blessing
know,
as far as, you know, appreciating the through line of the story.
Because that was going to be my question.
Yeah.
Did you go back and reference the end? The annotations as they were presented in the book, but
no, I didn't.
You didn't have the option.
No,
so.
I didn't thumb back through the book because I actually, you know, I was kind of like meh about the story, but I was excited about the journalistic aspect of the endnotes. So I think other folks will enjoy it. I have my issues because I started superimposing other stories that were of a similar ilk that, you know, I felt failed to deliver also. Maybe it's just tough when you create a huge ensemble story and you're dealing with a lot of fertile raw material to deliver on an original plot, because that was my big issue, was the plot just was really kind of thin.
Okay. Did you read this, Chris?
I read the first issue and I was okay with it. My main thing was just like, well, I've already read Creature Commandos and the Howling Commandos.
Precisely. And that's what it felt like.
And everybody
as well.
Wants to come back to those again and again. And I think they're a fun concept that can be put into a crossover with other characters. Mm-hmm. But I don't need to read a whole series about them again. Yeah. And it's not that I didn't like the first issue. I was just kind of like, that's what you are. Moving on. Mm-hmm. So
cool. All right. Cry Havoc. Thanks, Cole. Nicole, what about you?
What Chris was saying is starting to happen to me, where it's like I'm reading enough stories where if it's something that doesn't seem fresh, I'm just like, whatever. Yeah. I don't care.
Are you getting jaded?
Well, a little bit, but you know.
I think that's jaded. I think.
Well, actually, not even jaded. Yeah, I feel like I'm
soured.
No. I think it's like kid in a candy store when you've had all the sour candies. It better be something real special if it's a new sour candy.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing.
That's my personal definition of jaded. It's like.
No, I don't know. Maybe oversaturated.
A customer defined it much better for me on that, like, no, actually, your time is limited. You will die. Eventually. So it's best if you don't have to repeat the same crap again and again.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's nice to think that you're... It is.
Yeah, but it's true.
Yeah.
None of us are going to get out of here alive.
Yeah. Anyway.
Speak for yourself, brother.
All right, I'm sorry. Nicole, please.
Anyway, speaking of crap, I read Harley's Little Back Book number 4.
We're all gonna die.
Harley's Little Black Book.
Number 4. Yeah, this is the crossover with the DC Bombshells. If you don't know who the Bombshells are, they were just pinup girls of the DC universe. So you got like a Batwoman that was like League of Their Own. You know, you got like a Catwoman who...
I know there were statues, but there were actually
comics. Statues that started it all, and prints and all kinds of stuff. And then they made a comic... And it became kind of a other world sort of thing in the 1940s. I've talked about this series before, where the art bounced around so much that I just couldn't be bothered.
Okay.
Chris looked at this and there was something in here, like maybe Batwoman or something. I don't know. So he was just like, here, why don't you read that? And it's all your fault. No, I'm just kidding. that's not what I was getting at. But it's a one and done, so you don't have to read the other 3 issues, as far as I know. Well, she time travels because technology. Harley Quinn does, and she goes into this land where all the bombshells are, and they're trying to take down the Nazis and Hitler, and they've got this whole plan. Who cares? Yeah. So
let's go back in time and kill Hitler.
Harley Quinn beats him up in the car. She somehow gets, you know, she hitchhikes, and of course Hitler's car, you know, pulls over and lets this strange clown girl get in his car with no security, and she, you know, beats him up. And
well, maybe Hitler had a crazy clown girl fetish.
So one of the reasons I gave this to you was just because
these are the jokes.
One of the reasons I handed this, other than it had Batwoman in it, but was that, and this is a long way around, but I'll do it as quick as I can. So it's drawn by Billy Tukey and Joseph Michael Linsner. Billy Tukey is the creator of She, which is one of the things that started the bad girl trend of comics in the 90s. And Joseph Michael Linsner
was Cry for Dawn.
Did Dawn.
Yeah,
so
Dawn.
You have two guys
boobs
known.
Boobs and goth and boobs.
Yep. You have two guys known for being bad girl stuff. And now they're doing a book about a bad girl meeting good girls, and they're trying to be like good girl art during a bad girl thing, but they hired bad girl artists to do the good girl art. And it's just like,
wait, brain freeze.
So besides being a Let's Fight Hitler story, which I don't want to read, it also has characters in there that are flat. There's nothing. Kate Kane could be... You know, Big Bertha could be Kara Supergirl, could be whatever. It really doesn't matter who's wearing what skirt and who's saying what line, because they're all the same. So it's very, very flat. And then anything that's supposed to be cute and charming is just sort of meh. And that's a problem. I have no problem with boobies. In fact, I love them. So if it's something about pinup girls and stuff, I'm like, cool. But it has to have something. If it's tongue-in-cheek or if it's humor or something. You know, I read Fearless Dawn, which nobody knows but me. And it's a TNA cheesecake thing. And I like it, and that's my thing. But it's got Nazis in it, but it's very tongue-in-cheek, and it's very silly. And frou-frou, and so that's what it's got going for it, and this just doesn't give any of that.
All right.
Well, it's the illustrations are terrific, but from my experience, sometimes that just compounds the frustration when the story is lame.
Even the Harley Quinn of the DC Bombshells world falls flat.
Okay.
Like, you can't tell that she's Harley.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would argue that we don't know who Harley is anymore since her agency was totally obliterated following... You know,
well, it's all Puddin' and right. Whatever. So.
Well, once upon a time, there was a strength to her.
Cool. All right. Harley's Little Black Book number 4. Not recommended, says Nicole. All right.
Something not to like, right?
Yeah. Every Sometimes. Once in a while, you can't like everything. Chris Casso, what about you, sir?
So, Jonathan Hickman, known for lots of Marvel work and East of West, has launched a new Image title called The Black Monday Murders. Mm. So whenever I recommend East of West, I define it as a alternate history, sci-fi Western dystopian apocalypse.
You're adding to it now. Yeah. Dystopian's new.
And that's kind of like when he's at his best, it's when he's doing an alchemy of genres.
Mm.
So what this one is, it's a supernatural economic conspiracy murder mystery thriller.
All right.
And
but there's a goat skull on the cover.
Right. So there's...
Supernatural economic conspiracy murder mystery thriller Goat Skull.
Puma Blues.
So the story starts in 1929 on Black Thursday on the New York Stock Exchange.
Oh, okay.
And basically, there's a cult that's been running all the world banks since before this period to now. And it's very interesting because the one thing that Jonathan Hickman loves to do is to give you graphs. And
well, he's a graphic designer, though. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he does all the graphics for East of West, which I think is fascinating.
And symbology and all that stuff. Yeah. So he creates this cult, and he basically creates like a guidebook that you have to work to figure out the things that happen between time periods, because it jumps. And you learn like the structure of the cult, and you learn the positions and what happened to people, and you can intuit certain things that happened. So it's a dense read. It takes a bit of work. You're going to want a pen and paper. You want to kind of like, oh, what's that? Yeah. But it really does pay off. And it's really engaging. And the art is by Tom Coker, who has been in and out of the industry. And I think it takes him a lot of time to produce. So I hope this will be timely.
We have a few Hickman titles that are a little dead in the water right now. So
this is an ongoing?
This is an ongoing. Because
this sounds really fascinating, but I'm like, what would you say? Pick up individual?
Trade format would probably be better. Okay. A lot of Hickman reads better in the trade format, same way as Grant Morrison, because these guys do extensive plot development over time. And lots of graphs and symbols. But yeah, so this is a $5 book. It's actually already out of print. It's gone to second print, and it is well worth the time. I'm a big I get antsy when there's books that waste time for the amount of money that they charge, even if I think they were good. And this is one that you definitely get your money's worth. So, yeah, Black Monday Murders.
All right. Thanks, Chris. And that's Bookport, and that's our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street, beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or any RSS reader of your choice at Perfect Bound perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. We couldn't have given our show a smaller name. Anyway, also, before we go, I want to tell you that...
PBP!
I want to tell you that Sketchfest Seattle, a local nonprofit arts organization that I'm involved in, involved with, has our annual festival this weekend, Friday the 23rd and Saturday the 24th of September, 7 and 9 at Annex Theater, and we have sketch groups from all over the Northwest and Canada, mostly Canada, and because those Canadians are super dang funny. And come by, get info at sketchfest.org. I need to do a better job at marketing myself because I'm just kind of stumbling here. But anyway, come see Sketchfest. It's great. We are the first
Worst critic.
Sketch,
you know, I never
comedy
have to say anything
festival.
To him. He's done a great job.
The world. All
yes,
right.
It yes, it is. And Ben Lawrence is awesome.
Oh, thank you, Cole.
And we love Ben Lawrence.
Oh,
it's true.
Thank you, Cole. Oh, anyway, hey, put your quiz hats on, everybody, because it's quiz time. And this week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. All right. I got to give you a little backstory on this one. I had the flu over Labor Day weekend, and I had all these plans for my 3-day weekend, and I was totally wiped out. But I discovered Comet TV.
Comet TV.
Yes. Did you watch Cherry 2000?
It's on Comcast. It's 328 on the dial. It is the best geek station in the world.
It's got a lot of weird things on
it. And so they run Outer Limits. They Mystery Science Theater 3000 back to back on Sunday nights, like the Joel episodes.
Yep.
Joel. So, sorry, I'm a cord cutter. I don't have the cable.
Okay. Well, actually, it's on the webs too.
Oh, is that on the webs?
It's on the webs too. But they also were running Roger Corman films.
They had a Godzilla marathon.
But they were running the Roger Corman films from the 60s, the drive-in movies, the ones, the Edgar Allan Poe ones, and they ran, and I watched The Raven back-to-back a couple of times, and that's Vincent Price at his best.
Yes.
And Vincent Price and Jack Nicholson in that one, very young Jack Nicholson.
Oh, yeah.
And Boris Karloff, you know, in these cheesy, low-budget movies. Peter Lorre is wonderfully charming characterizations. Just so that inspired me for this quiz time.
Yeah, very good.
This
Yay.
Quiz time is called Something to Crow About.
Woo!
All questions relate to comic books and characters derived from the La Familia Corvidae, or crows and their ilk. First up, severely OCD museum curator turned super thief Margaret Pye has a gift for converting those shiny trinkets she steals into deadly weapons for the foils of her flightiness like Batman and Superman. Who is she?
Magpie?
You got it! The Magpie Queen!
Oh my god.
Margaret Pye. Come on.
The Magpie, created by John Byrne, first appeared in Man of Steel number 3 in 1986.
That was fantastic.
That was lovely. In an alternate future where H.G. Wells' Martian invaders returned for a second strike and succeeded in subjugating the human race, this red-headed renegade gladiator leads a ragtag group of Freeman across the battle-ravaged surface of planet Earth. You go,
Killraven.
Killraven is absolutely right. Killraven first appeared in Amazing Adventures Volume 2, 18 from Marvel Comics in 1973. Now, this character was once a special government agent on the trail of a swamp creature he was convinced murdered scientists Alec and Linda Holland. This point of confusion is eventually resolved years following that whole swamp thing. This fellow finds himself comatose following a drunk driving incident. He regains consciousness, but in the Sandman's realm of the dreaming. But he no longer wears the form of a man. In fact, he's now the winged companion of the Lord of Dreams. Who is this?
Michael? Daniel.
Roger.
Jeff.
Oh, you're breaking my
Jeremy.
Heart. Matthew the Raven. First appeared as Matt Siebel.
More than Bible names.
Matthew. Matthew the Raven first appeared as Matt Cable in Swamp Thing number 1 in 1972, and as Matthew the Raven, the Raven, in Sandman 11 in 1989.
All right.
You are such a good sport. I love you.
What's next?
This character surreptitiously formed the new Teen Titans to combat her father, the multi-browed demon lord Trigon. Her catchphrase, Azerath Metrion Xynthos, is the password for the email accounts of many a millennial. Who is she?
Raven?
Yeah.
That's right. Wow. Raven first appeared in DC Comics Presents number 26 in 1980. Resurrected on the violent streets of Detroit, Eric Draven was an undead spirit of vengeance that spoke to the goth punk culture in ways his creator, J.O. Barr, could never have foreseen, becoming a franchise that covered not only comics, but novels, films, television, and yes, action figures. Sadly, this character will forever be associated with the onset death of actor Brandon Lee.
The Crow.
There
Birdman.
Birdman.
Published by Caliber Comics in 1989. The first film was released in 1994, but look for a new film adaptation in 2017.
Holy crap, really?
That's right. Yep.
Alrighty. Yep. Cool. Thank you, Cole. And that is... Thank you, Crow. And that is our show. And thank you for listening and or watching, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.